Welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio. This is Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican. It's good, as always, to have you with me. And if you heard of the show last week, you know that I am not stateside. I have been travelling around Europe. I was in Slovenia and the Czech Republic doing some Liberty camps. And the second leg of my journey, I am pleased to say, is seeing family. And I am therefore in what we lovingly call us Brits, Blighty, which is the English slang for England. And I am actually staying with my uncle for a few days. And the reason I'm telling you that is that for some time I have wanted to get him on this radio show. So today we're keeping it in the family, you might say. Now the reason I would like to talk to him on air for my Blue Republican audience is that I think my uncle, his name is John, I think John has had an interesting kind of political journey through his life. He was, for most of his career, a elementary school teacher. So he was what in the States we would call a public sector worker, and a unionized one at that. Is that right, John?
That's absolutely right.
And usually voting Labour, which is kind of, you know, the British translation of Democratic, right?
Yeah.
Democratic Party. And so a glance at John's kind of political history would tell you, would suggest that he was a bit of a lefty, but that might not be a fair interpretation, as we will discuss. But actually, quite recently, in his hometown, as it then was, of Brighton, he went even, quote, further left, and went from the Labour Party to the Green Party. But the reason I wanted to talk to him on this show is that now he is a UKIP supporter. Now, I know that there's a lot of discussion among Americans who are interested in UKIP as to whether they are libertarian or to what extent they're libertarian. But that's not what we're going to discuss here. I'm interested in UKIP as an example of a non-main party, a third party, making waves with an anti-establishment message, essentially, against the mainstream politics of, in this case, the UK. Now, if you glance at the UKIP's policies, as some of the media have, they say, oh, well, these UKIPs are UKIPers, these kippers, are really their policies are conservative, or we might say Republican. And so they kind of appeal to the political right, and they pull off disaffected conservatives. But interestingly, in the by-elections that have recently been held, not only did they win a seat from the Conservatives, they almost won a seat from the Labour Party, from the left, in the more left-wing north of England. And it seems that whereas the UKIP is making a political connection, maybe with people on the right, they've made a cultural connection with people on the left. My uncle is now quite a committed supporter of UKIP. And I just think, as I said earlier, that his kind of political journey is an interesting one. And there might be a lesson in it for activists like me, like many of my friends over here in the States, who are all about changing minds politically. And that, of course, is something that I am very interested in, something I talk a lot about. So maybe we'll call my uncle a case study in this, but we'll find out. So, John, welcome to the show. Thanks for kind of doing this.
It's my pleasure.
So you have had an interesting story. I've kind of given you, I've kind of summarized your political history to the listeners, which may or may not have been fairly done. So correct me on anything, or fill in any gaps, or at least give us a sense of how it was you used to vote or engage politically.
Right. Well, I think it was a fair synopsis, actually, that you gave. But I think that my main thrust would be that I've always wanted to feel that my vote was relevant and going to be important. But I was always affected throughout my career by the fact that I was an elementary teacher. And I would have leaned towards a party that might have supported my career path, if you like, and supported education in particular. But I think that throughout my lifetime, I've always looked for a party that would listen and actually have policies that were personal to me. And that's been very difficult to find here, because through my lifetime, it seems that the parties have grown further and further away from me. And I think that I'm typical of a person who feels fairly disenfranchised in that the parties seem to be self-motivating, self-perpetuating, and don't listen to the public particularly. And I still vote. My concern is that there's an awful lot of people in this country who are so disenfranchised, they literally do not vote. They feel that their vote isn't going to be important or vital. And I find that quite sad. And I think that typically now, I've found a party that does listen, wants to give power and decision-making back to the local areas. And that is just what I want to hear. And I think a lot of people who are disaffected with the Labour Party, the Tory Party, and people who wouldn't have used their vote wisely in the past or used it at all may actually have found in the UKIP policies policies that they feel react to what they want, and they feel like that it's not just a protest. For some people it might be, but I think the established parties are being given a bit of a bloody nose, if you like, at the moment, in as far as they are struggling to keep their number of voters, and that they're all losing them to some regard, perhaps, to UKIP. UKIP certainly is of interest to a lot of the populace.
Do you remember the actual changing of your mind when you kind of start, the moment of, I no longer identify, anything in particular, I no longer identify Labour or Green or whatever, I think I can actually pin my colours to this mast. Wasn't it at a meeting where you heard Farage speak or something like that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that having a leader like Nigel Farage, a charismatic personality, is something that's been lacking in British politics for quite some time. And just his personality makes people listen. And he's such a very, very strong orator, and talks obviously about his experiences that are typical of the common person in Britain. And he certainly had a big influence on me. But up until then, I think I was a bit of a butterfly in that I would vote Labour because they were looking at education seriously. I voted Green and was responsible for the only Green MP in this country, partly. Because I thought, because I was teaching Green policies, and it seemed to be this was the future. I think I may have got it badly wrong. Certainly in Sussex with the Green MP, it seems to have gone fairly badly wrong.
How so?
Well, they've implemented green issues. They've put in the most wonderful, exciting cycle lanes that you ever want to see. they've welcomed the traveller groups with open arms.
We're talking like the Romanies here, are we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if
for my American audience you don't know what the Romanies are, get in on Wikipedia and find out. Because in some countries in Europe, such as Slovakia, they represent a serious proportion of the population and a serious problem, because they basically don't conform to the Western norms, right, of, you know, property rights, of you earn what you have to earn your living. They don't, this is, it's a travelling culture that don't have some of these norms. But yeah, so the Greens invited all of them to turn up in the parks of Sussex.
And they did. They certainly did. But some of the parks, to be fair, are beautifully kept. However, the finances have proved difficult for them, because That they've also been anti-car in the centre of the city of Brighton, and the traders have responded badly to that because they want people in to shop, and as Brighton city centre is anti-car, the transport isn't fabulous, so people who travel any distance are inclined to go elsewhere rather than go to Brighton, where they have to park and then ride in on other transport.
And I should also say for my American listeners here that Brighton is a major British city south of London, that some people call, perhaps with the tongue in cheek, the San Francisco of Great Britain, because of its friendliness towards such things as the LGBT community and so on. And I mean, I've heard this said many times about Brighton, right?
Absolutely. London by the Sea is...
London by the Sea.
Is what it is referred to here. I feel that's a part of my political career that didn't go swimmingly well, really. Having heard Nigel Farage speak, I obviously look further into the policies. And I've also heard Steve Crowther, who you know.
Steve Crowther, who I should mention, we interviewed on this show. It was a great interview. Check it out in the archives on bluerepublican.org. Yes, Steve Crowther, the chairman of UKIP.
And I find Steve Crowther a very intelligent man. And he influenced me probably more than Nigel Farage. But Farage is the face that people in Britain see. It's definitely... The policy here that he has, that the UKIP has, is they are the only party in this country that offers Britain to come out of Europe. And this is the big thorny issue at the moment. I think a lot of the populace are waking up to the fact that we joined the EU, we joined a common market, which seemed to be sense. And a lot of people who voted for us to join a common market, to trade with each other only, without giving up any sort of sovereignty or rights or regulation of our own views and policies, it's taken tens of years to realise that actually this was always going to be the plan, to work towards a United States of Europe. Well, at some stage, that's got to be questioned, and it's now being questioned seriously, and UKIP's main policy is, we start by coming out. We save all the money of that we pay to be in for not a good return. In fact, it's a damaging return to many industries in this country. The Labour Party won't consider leaving Europe. They think that we have to stay as part of Europe, which appears to be a road to financial disaster. The Tory party are making noises about and promises that they will renegotiate, which actually probably can't happen, because the situation is that the EU tells each member state how much they have to pay, and these are the regulations that are now in play because of the number of treaties that are being passed and signed. So the only way for a lot of people in Britain to feel that we can get Great Britain back again is to go back to the time when we traded with America, the Commonwealth, the rest of the world, and we really ought to be making our own trade arrangements with China and the up-and-coming countries without having to be shackled by European legislation or deals. A lot of people feel that this has got to be the way forward. That I belong to a small number of people who remember voting in Britain when we were a sovereign country. But it does concern me that an awful lot of our population has known nothing else in their lifetime. They've grown up being part of the EU. It was just there for them. But I remember that we didn't join the group that is now turned into, we joined a trading group, and I think a lot of the Tory party, a lot of people realise that we should review now our situation. Well, even Cameron realises we need to renegotiate.
Cameron, the British Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think Europe is going to be a very big policy in 2015 election. And it was only this year, earlier this year, of course, that we had the European elections in this country where we elected MEPs.
Members of the European Parliament, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, the results of that spoke volumes. And UKIP obviously has grown off the back of that.
UKIP won that.
Well, the resounding, yes, UKIP had a tremendous number of elected members, and that was saying we need to be reconsidering very strongly our place in the EU. And off the back of that, the momentum seems to be growing day by day, and the support seems to be for a party that actually will direct us, and the direction of the UKIP party is that we come out of Europe, become a sovereign state. Because what we've given to Europe is the rights to rule us. A tremendous amount of our legislation is dictated to us by European policies. And I believe the latest figure is that our say in any decision-making is as low as 6 or 7%.
As a nation.
Because there are far more many groups, far more many countries that belong to the EU now. And UKIP are definite that they want to bring regulation control from Brussels, Europe, back to London initially, and then from London to disperse the decision-making to the communities, to the areas where people have got their own particular decisions that they want dealt with.
It stands for localism.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a very strong policy that will talk to the electorate here.
Do you said earlier that you were voting your interest. You know, you would vote Labour because you were in education, and you know that you had the sense that they supported public education, so that would benefit you as an individual. Is it the fact that you now are retired from that career that enables you to consider and vote perhaps more philosophically or on broader issues?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. I do feel a little bit guilty because having voted Green and taught Green issues, I don't know whether it's the same in the United States as it is in Britain, but in the British education curriculum, the Green Party that we have is supported, surprisingly, in that Green issues are taught in our education system. The renewable energy resources, waste management, so on, are all taught to the youngsters in this country.
And you've been teaching them. You were teaching them as a teacher.
And I am guilty of having taught these things. And it was brought home to me very recently, having left education, that, yes, I was doing this. And it smacks of a little bit of directing the future voting public towards a particular party. I think green issues are looked on almost like health issues, that they are good, and they would be if they were effective, financially viable, we had the technology developed to implement them. But of course, I've learned
them economically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And of course, what I've learned is that, in theory, harnessing wind from wind power from wind would be wonderful, and it sounds free, but of course it isn't. And since I've left education, I realise that in the real world, that it may be a nice idea, But to actually, if it was effective, viable, we'd have been doing it tens of years ago. But of course, the windmill hasn't been replaced by any other wind energy, and there are reasons for that. We haven't got the technology to do it efficiently anywhere in the world. Otherwise, it would have been there in my lifetime.
Tell the story about the that you told me before we started this show, about the young teenage lad that you met at a UKIP meeting, I believe.
I was very impressed because over here, a lot of flack is given that a lot of UKIP members are elderly. And I went to a meeting earlier this year where there were youngsters, and I was thrilled to see that. And one particular lad, who was 14 at most, was brave enough to ask a question of the energy policy. And he was projecting the idea that we should be looking at renewable energies, water, wind, solar power. And I thought, that sounds like me teaching him here. And I've heard this before.
And you said that he said in his question that because they're free.
Yes, right. Exactly. He said, this is the future, this should be the policy. There doesn't seem to be any regard in UKIP's policies, or strong enough regard, for renewable energies being followed seriously. And they should be, because they're free. And I thought, once upon a time I thought that, but I've discovered that they are expensive to implement. They don't exist anywhere on a big scale because they're not viable.
And where they do exist, they're invariably subsidised.
And I think, yes, that the myth is perpetuated in Britain particularly. When you travel around and you see patches of wind turbines, a field of solar panels, and you think, the future's arriving, it's being implemented, we're going in the right direction, it's off and running, it will escalate now. But when you actually look into it, what you're seeing is people that have taken advantage of EU subsidies to put up wind turbines, to allocate land for solar farms. And that is the extent of it. They are not efficient, but the people that have put these up are taking the money because it's there and available.
Government handout.
It's our money coming back in a small way. Our membership money.
Membership of the EU. You're saying this is coming from the EU.
That's
these
right.
Subsidies, yeah.
I don't know if you're... the latest figure I was told was that it costs Britain £55 million a day. It's probably gone up since then. I think they were talking about 70 is the latest that we're going to be asked to pay for our membership. And the subsidies that come back here are positive in that the renewables are being subsidised, the wind turbines, the solar panels. Individuals are being subsidised to put these up, and there are people taking advantage of that. Why wouldn't they? But too many subsidy issues have been negative over here in terms of farming particularly, where farmers are subsidised not to leave land fallow. In other words, don't grow anything.
Or in some instances actually paid to destroy food.
Indeed.
So
the situation, I think, is sinking in here that EU makes all the policies and provides them to us, and we react to them, and we feel that we should have more of that power in our hands, and we as a nation should be determining and leading the world like we used to. This is the thing, and you'll often hear about trying to bring the great back to Great Britain, because we used to lead the world in various technologies and fields of business, not only finance or whatever, but we seem to now be being directed rather than being leaders in anything. We've handed that over to China.
Do you think that relates? You mentioned, obviously, we've been talking about education quite a lot. You know, I see you're talking about the green indoctrination that kind of you see in the education system. I see a lack of history teaching. I talk a lot, I mean, my listeners and my readers in the US know that I write a lot about kind of the Anglo history and the history of liberty and the history of freedom, economic freedom, you know, the free market on the one hand, but also civil liberties and all these things that were gestated and developed in the Anglo world, chiefly, you know, in Great Britain, certainly until, like, you know, America started up in the 18th century. I feel that because of a lack of education of who the British are and the British history, and, you know, a lack of education about British identity itself, there is that young people, those who have not known anything except the EU, as you mentioned, they don't know even what they've given up and what they continue to give up by our participation in this political monstrosity. There is no understanding of what we've done and what we've been that makes that they value, that they want to hold on to. They don't know that they've lost anything. And that's also isn't that also a problem of education? I mean, in a way, in the long run, this problem has to be solved in education, does it not?
Well, the classic the time in British history when education was deemed to be important was when Blair was Prime Minister over here. And
Blair Labour Party, we're talking around the year 2000?
1995.
Okay.
And his banner was education, education, education. Well, he got into power on the back of that because he seemed to be the person who realised what needed to be addressed, but he didn't follow it through. He got elected on that, but didn't actually see it through and make the inroads that he should have done. But you're right. People don't realise that we have had leading figures in. So many aspects of life, and I think it goes in hand with the fact that we've lost our value too in being able to make our own decisions locally.
Okay. So when you say what you mean by that, I presume, is because we're now not used to making our own decisions. It's not something that we are any good at, that we insist on, that we are used to, and that we therefore, you know, that we are aware of having lost again.
Yeah, I think it goes hand in hand with people not seeing people being successful individually and leading the world, and not knowing the country as a sovereign, independent, governing country. And this current generation has known no different. But
do you think
the history, if history was taught and showed our place, I think not just the older generation, but the rest of the people might realise that we could actually get back to that situation where we could be independent, leading, explorative, experimental, leading research. At the moment, we have to kowtow to EU regulations. We seem to have lost our drive and direction.
Do you... when you were in that meeting, just going back, like that first kind of UKIP meeting where you started to make this change, and you said that you feel that here was a person, a party that perhaps understood you, was hearing you, and that you hadn't had that for, you know, a while. Was it what he was saying, or was it the way he was saying it?
It was both.
Okay.
As I mentioned earlier, Farage is a very strong orator, but UKIP were brave enough to address issues that were deemed by everybody else to be controversial because they didn't want to be discussing them,
They were politically incorrect, you might say, in some way, right? No?
The issues were there of immigration. The general public knew that there were Poles in London working cheaper than the workers that were there before, and that there was this input of immigrants coming over and
that we couldn't control, being the point.
Well, it didn't seem to be that we could control, and we began to question whether there actually was any control. And of course, we were told that this was EU policy, that there's an open border policy, anybody can go anywhere we like in Europe, and that we benefited from that both ways, that we were getting in workers that we needed, whether it was in the health service, whether it was labourers or whatever. And similarly, the borders were open, and a lot of Brits apparently are taking advantage of going across Europe and working wherever they want in Europe. But more and more and more, the feeling of the general public is that actually, I think we're being misled. That we see loads of immigrants waiting on the French border, waiting to come in, and I don't know whether the Americans are aware of all the stories of how the Eastern European, particularly groups, are coming to the French border and risking their lives to some extent to try and get to Britain, and they quite openly say when they're asked, well, you've travelled across lots of European countries, why didn't you make your home in one of the others? And they said, well, we're going to Britain because it offers us allowances, accommodation. They'll look after us.
You're talking about welfare.
Now
that's interesting, because that's obviously another huge issue. I mean, that Britain has just an unbelievably huge problem with the welfare state, and we could do 10 shows just on that. Mm. Now, as a Labour voter back in the day, well, you might not have deliberately been voting for a bigger welfare state, but you're effectively voting for a bigger welfare state, and even now. That's a big part of, the Labour idea is, just increase the welfare state. And now, by voting UKIP, you're voting the other way on the welfare state.
Yes. You've got to remember that back in the day, in the 60s, 70s, I was a student, and students tend to think that they know more than the rest of the population, and you have this sort of inbuilt sense of fairness. Everybody deserves an equal share on whatever, and you don't have any sense of budget, but you think surely we can look after everybody and make sure everybody's comfortable, and I think it came from that sort of feeling, really. And it's taken probably my lifetime for me to realise that fair is always a good word to use, because that seems to have got some merit. But trying to be fair obviously isn't as straightforward. And through my lifetime, I've seen the church put under the microscope. The MPs aren't as honest and as I was led to believe. The banks that were always going to be a fail-safe, they were always going to be sound and healthy. All of these things are undermined with a lack of fairness. And experience sort of makes you realise that somebody responsible needs to grab control. And that's happening, I think, in this country. We need somebody who we think is real. Too many politicians at the moment in this country seem to be in the job for the sake of their job. They want to keep that going. They're not in it for anything meritorious. They seem to be there because it's a job they want to perpetuate.
Now, that's very cynical, though, because don't you think that most politicians get in because they genuinely feel, they might be misguided, but they genuinely feel they can make their society better? Do you not think that that's a common instinct, even among the political class?
I think you may feel that when you're younger. You would want to feel that that was the case, but with the internet and so many exposés, you begin to wonder actually what the motives are for people that are governing the country.
Now, how does that bear on the welfare state, though? Are you saying that because these institutions and these people are less trustable, we want to put in their gift less because they abuse more? You know, we want them administering less, making decisions about less because they can't be trusted in those decisions. Well, I mean, how
the danger always was that if you have an open border policy, you don't know whether you're going to get a net gain of population into your country or a net loss. But you don't have to be Einstein to work out whether the countries in Europe, some countries are getting a net loss, Romania, Bulgaria,
net loss of people, population.
Yeah. Because they see and they expect to move to other countries that are going to give them a better standard of living. And those countries are Britain, number one, France, possibly Spain, but Spain's having its own issues. But at least they've got the climate. The figures show that not a lot of people are going to be going to Romania.
So a lot of people would say, but this is great, you know, if there's jobs available here and people want to come and improve their standard of living, it all adds to our economy, so what's the problem? Why should the Brits be worried about it?
Yeah, that was how we were sold the whole EU idea. But reality is that we haven't got the infrastructure, we haven't got the money to cope with all the people that come over here. That we know about, and this is a big issue in this country at the moment, is border restriction, border control. We were told by the government that we knew people, the amount of people coming into this country and the amount of people leaving. Then they had a border review, which didn't amount to a great deal. It was a paper exercise, and more we realised that the figures that we're given are figures that they know about, but investigations have shown us that there are immigrant groups over here that are over here illegally, and there is open immigration happening at our borders, the regulations being flouted daily, and we're having trouble just monitoring illegal immigrants coming across in boats, underneath lorries, inside trucks, all manner of ways that they're attempting to come in. And these people aren't known about. And
when you say we don't have the money, you're talking about because we have a health service that is paid for by the taxpayer, an education system that's paid for by the taxpayer, obviously infrastructure that's paid for by the taxpayer, things that kind of go through the state that you're saying that these immigrants they're taking out of the pot, but they're not putting in. And of course, the UK is unusual in that we have a non-contributory welfare system, right? You Absolutely. Arrive and you can, because you're here, you can sign up and get benefits.
Absolutely, it was anecdotal, but there is evidence that a lot of Europeans come to this country and they openly say we're coming because we will be given a house, we will be given money to live on, and this is why they won't stop in France, they don't stop in other European countries, because the package being offered.
The welfare package is not.
Doesn't compete with the one that Britain will offer them. And we're paying the price for that. And a lot of British people are saying, "Hang on, we need to have some sort of restriction," because I think that the classic phrase is, "Isn't Britain full yet?" We're concerned that we can't just keep taking more and more
And England now is the most densely populated country in Europe, I think. I mean, I think it used to be the Netherlands or something, but I think we're now number. I mean, I would
believe that.
Yeah.
Because we're only a small country. People forget that we're a very small country, really. And I think that the concern is that our monies are being provided for, and it is now become almost a civil issue where native British people are prioritised down the list below non-English speaking people because they seem to be needy because of their lack of the language. They need instant support in terms of housing, food, etc.
So it's almost because they're not integrated, we're going to give them more. Absolutely.
And built into the open border policy is no opportunity for a country to say, well, we ought to have some sort of capping on the numbers, otherwise this could become unwieldy.
Or at least be able to choose who we have in on what terms.
Well, the EU would say open is open.
Right.
Unfortunately. But UKIP, you see, has already said that the first thing that needs to be, one of the early things to be done is to have real control over who comes in and out and some sort of selection. You know, this can be controversial because over here people will say selection might go against somebody's rights. Well, they'll go against their European rights at the moment, that's for sure. So I think it would give the opportunity to review the rights. And I think a country needs to have control or some sort of immigration control. And the sexy one for the Brits, I think, is the Australian model. But we can't at the moment because EU tells us what we can and can't do in terms of emigration and immigration.
So really, we can talk about these different issues, education, immigration, whatever, but what's really motivating the shift, like at a more fundamental level, is a sense of lack of control on the one hand and a sense of lack of fairness on the other hand. Is that fair?
That's absolutely right. Fairness for people who always were needy. We've always had our people that have needed supporting, and the worry is that they may suffer and that we need to support them better before we increase the number of benefit people that we take on board.
So do you think now, John, that you know, our times are changing? Are we really living through a fundamental realignment in British politics?
I actually think it may be. I remember the SDP.
That's the Social Democratic Party.
I think they had four MPs, and they seemed to have some momentum, but that fizzled out and disappeared. But I don't think UKIP is going to go away. All the time that Europe is the group that we are a member of, and the more disgruntled people are at what we get for our membership, I think UKIP will always be there to ask the question, is this worthwhile? Is this working? I've just thought of one of the things that really did upset me about Europe, and I think any right-thinking person who wants to join a group of countries where it has two centres of government. When I found out that Brussels and Strasbourg shared the home of the parliaments, and that they moved with loads of pantechnicons, they moved the secretaries.
That's big trucks. Yeah.
They moved the secretaries, the MPs, and I believe it's something like every month or every 2 months.
Yeah, it's like every
month. It is ludicrous. They move the whole lot across to Strasbourg. And then they'll move it back from Strasbourg to Brussels.
It's like moving Capitol Hill to New York and then back again the next month. And the cost of that is just phenomenal, right?
The cause of that was that when France joined, they wanted to be deemed to have an important role, and they wanted a share of the headquarters or to be seen to be important. So we end up with two. But that's happened ever since. By now, the finances it should have said, this is ridiculous. We can't justify this on any level. But they continue to move, and they continue to bear the cost. Or we continue to bear the cost.
People, yeah.
That was one of the issues that I couldn't quite understand. It's remarkable that any place that is governed has two centres, and they move them backwards and forwards. It's ludicrous.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so here's a question, and I don't mean to spring this on you, because I know we haven't discussed this, but one of the things that's particularly interesting to me about UKIP, and I know would be to my listeners, is that, and I've said this to a lot of my libertarian friends who ask me about UKIP in the United States, UKIP calls itself a small L libertarian party. Does that mean anything to you?
Yes, it does.
What does it mean to you?
Because it means to me that it's a party that is saying each individual should have a stronger say. The way they intend to do that is, as I say, they want to bring sovereignty back to London, sovereignty of the country, but they are so in favour of establishing local government. There's even talk of VAT or a local income tax, and that stays in the regions.
We like that. Rather than being sent up to the feds, as it would be, in the States, and then sent back down.
Well,
you know,
it's
with
even worse
strings.
Than that, because at the moment we send our taxes, we send our monies to London, they send it to Brussels. Brussels will dribble it back, and then it will get shared out.
Mm.
And that is so remote, it's untrue. At the beginning of my lifetime, there were local authorities that had power, like parish councils, borough councils, who made decisions locally. And it's almost like the UKIP strategy is to return to that. And I think that would be wonderful, because I don't care what country you live in. I think everybody who's got a vote would like to think that their vote actually affected decisions that affect them. Mm. So local decisions are the obvious ones. When in one part of a country, it may be a road system that needs to be sorted through. And UKIP is talking about holding referendums on big local issues, so that the people actually do see their say have an effect. That's what appeals to me.
Okay, so does the word libertarian mean anything more than localism to you?
Well, freedom to have a your own future in your
to
own
to make
hands.
Your own way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas now we've, at the moment, I think the Tory Party, the Labour Party, seem to be still wanting to keep government at a distance.
Okay.
So
in the broadest sense of empowerment of the individual, at the expense of a big state.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And over here, I'm sure that. People are aware that one of the things aimed at UKIP is that they are racist. But anybody that analyses that will find out that in fact they are the least racist of all the parties in this country. We're not, the UKIP policy is not racist as such. It is wanting control of our country, and
which is what self-determination is about, isn't it? It's self-determining
Absolutely.
One's community. Yeah, and setting a community, setting its own rules through its own decision-making.
It is. And in terms of the makeup of the members of the elite of each party, UKIP has as diverse a group as
yeah.
as any other.
Yeah.
So its members come from a broad range of cultures.
Yeah. So do you think? I don't think I've ever heard the word libertarian used to discuss politics in the UK. Is it a word that you ever would have used before UKIP, or do you think it's a word that more English people are understanding and using now, or is it just still something that, like, libertarian, what's that?
I think it's still very new. The more people that you, like Steve Crowther, that gets their voice heard, I think the more that people will relate to the message.
Do you think it would be helpful for UKIP to start using that word a lot more? Because right now they're given these labels like right wing populist or you know blah blah, you know, disaffected conservative or whatever. But libertarian seems to be such a more positive, forward looking, and not only forward looking, actually in the very best sense backward looking. Because the tradition of libertarianism and classical liberalism is an English tradition, as
Absolutely.
You know I'm always discussing with my American friends. You know, it's an Anglo tradition. Now, obviously, now you know with the flag being best carried in the United States, I think most people would say. But you know, that libertarianism with a small L is something that is kind of naturally English, is naturally Anglo, and I say it's sometimes very good. One of the reasons UKIP is so effective is that they don't lead with a big philosophy and a big word, but they try and connect, as you've described in this last hour. They connect on particular issues of disaffection, which is what, you know, liberty folks in the United States have to get much better doing. But on the other hand, you can take that too far. You know, you can appear to be a hodgepodge of negative, which is what the media sometimes thrown at them, you know, kind of negative stands on things. Whereas actually there's a really positive philosophy at the core here. If UKIP truly is libertarian, and there's some question about whether it is.
Yeah, I think that UKIP are strong on the fact that their base is that some of the rights and freedoms of people all over the world have come from doctrines that were set up in this country, and that we should be getting back to the rights that we set up to govern ourselves and to have says in our things, that we want to return to basic wills and needs of the British people.
Do you think there's? I mean, we probably should end this in a couple of minutes. But do you think now there is a turn against, for the first time certainly in my lifetime, government as the solution to all social and economic problems? That people have gone like the social democratic model, the big government, the welfare state. Are people maybe even educated enough to go, hold on, that was all great in theory, but we've now basically tested that for a good half century and we need something new?
I think the ground is ripe to be tilled with seeds of another way of approaching things. The health system is in desperate need of a review, radical review.
And we have socialised medicine, the National Health Service.
Indeed,
that's what you're talking about.
Because it's free at the point of use, that's a wonderful thing to hang on to. But it's so unwieldy now. When it was set up, it was a very basic provision for everybody. And it seemed to make sense. Now it is huge. It's too big. One minute you're looking at cosmetic surgery, you're looking at IVF. It was never meant to be this. It was meant to be a basic health coverage for everybody. And I think it's got to be grasped and I think trimmed, the free element trimmed, and but it's not a vote winner to say we're going to take anything outside the NHS, even though they're peripheral and. But I think somebody like UKIP will be brave enough to trim the national health to a common core of needs, and there'll have to be an insurance provision or a personal provision for the things on the edges, there are other issues that I think people at the moment are. At the point of disaffection where they want to shout, for goodness sake, listen to me. And one of the pushes of UKIP is less government, more power. They want to be governed.
More power whom?
Well, to the individual.
To the individual, okay, yeah. Yeah.
More power to the individual, less government from outside, whether it be from London or Brussels. Or anywhere that's distant.
That's a pretty libertarian note right there, and probably a good place to end. We've given this a really good shot, and we've spoken for the really up to the hour. And as my regular listeners know, this is a new format. I used to have to break this show every few minutes, and there'd be music and news and ads. But I hope you guys out there listening to this are enjoying the new format. I really am grateful to my good uncle John. Everybody has a favorite uncle. This is mine, and not just because he's seen the political light and is now your regional manager of UKIP, right, for your mm-hmm. local region. There mm-hmm. you go. So I hope you found that interesting. I hope there's some lessons in there.
Is this the time when I do my request for a piece of music?
Well, I'll probably tag one on the beginning and the end. We'll see how that goes. Join me next week for another edition of Blue Republican Radio. Thanks, as always, for being with me. Please go to bluerepublican.org. Sign up. We can activate the American disaffected independents if we know who you are. There's 15,000 Blue Republicans on Facebook. I'd like to get 15,000 emails at bluerepublican.org. And we'll give you some goodies for that, like discounts on merchandise, if you're interested in that kind of thing. And if not, that's fine too. Have a great week, and join me next week for Blue Republican Radio. Take care. Bye.